The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media. From north of the wall to the southern tip of Dorne to the Stepstones to Essos to the Shy by the Shadow, it's all here. Come from all parts of Planetos and sit down with us to talk Game of Thrones. This is Casterly Talk. I'm Ken Napsok, and I am joined this time again, much like last week was, Rachel Cushing and Lon Harris are here. Hello, friends.
Hello.
Lords and ladies.
Hello.
Yes. We are getting real close here. April 14th is the premiere date, season 7. Now, we are pre-recording this, so in the off chance there's a teaser, a full trailer, we will do, or by the time you're hearing, we'll have had a special episode up. I'll get some people in here and we'll do it, but this is a pre-taped episode, so that's the danger in this fast-moving pop culture world. We're going on the faith that HBO is holding everything close to the chest. We are here getting ready for season 8, and Lon, Rachel, how are your preparations for season 8 going? Rachel, where you at?
So I had my big rewatch in the fall, so I feel really solid about
that. Head of the game.
Yep. But I am contemplating rewatching, if not all of season 7, then at least maybe the last 3 to 4 episodes, just because by nature of rewatches, every time there's a new season, you go back to the old seasons and you rewatch them. And so at this point, like, how many times have I seen season 1? It's, I don't even know, but dozens probably.
Right.
But season 7, obviously having seen it the least amount of time. So I might, honestly, for the fun of it, get a few more of those in.
Yeah, we joked off air. I think I've seen that pilot 49 times, the first episode, because I just start there. And then also, a lot of times randomly during the off seasons or something, I'm like, I want to watch some Game of Thrones. You know, I like that scene. It's fun to go back and watch them when they're all young. Mm-hmm. So that's that. Lon, I know you've been doing some work over for the fine folks, our friends at Screen Junkies.
Sure, yeah.
And preparing the Kramit series. So you've been buried in this.
This is going to be my life until the show debuts. Basically, is going through and summarizing each season and then finding all the clips and lining everything up and making it look nice.
So you got to be your own assistant editor here? You got to pull the clips
too? I'm not doing the editing.
No,
basically,
sure.
The script is, I write, here's what's happening, and then I go to this time code in episode 3 for the good shot of the dragon arriving or whatever. So yeah, it's really combing through the episodes and a lot of decision making, because you can't summarize everything. It's too dense.
Cannot.
So you have to decide, you know, which stories, because some stories reach kind of a natural endpoint.
Sure. Like,
do I need to discuss Roz the prostitute? Do we need to get into Barristan Selmy and what happens to him? Because those stories kind of find a natural endpoint.
Right.
But there may be things, like, I'll give you a quick example.
Love it.
Season 1, there's a scene where Ned Stark, he's first arrived in King's Landing and he's meeting the Small Council for the first time. Now, nothing that they're discussing matters.
Sure.
They're talking about
the tournament.
This Targaryen girl in the east. Mm-hmm. I wonder what's going on there. And yes, like they're broke because the Tywin Lannister has been loaning them all this money, and they don't have enough money to throw the tournament. And
right.
So you could just skip that scene because it's like, they're not talking about anything important. Mm-hmm. But you can't skip that scene because you need to introduce Littlefinger and Renly Baratheon and Lord Varys and Grand Maester Pyzel. So there's tons of situations like that where it's like, I can just skip the tournament. I can't because that's when the Hound and the Mountain both are there. When you meet Sir Loras, the Knight of the Flowers, you need to know for later. So you keep running into that situation. They're like, two steps forward, one step back. I have to do this scene because this important other thing that I didn't think was that important.
What is interesting writing this now going into season 8, you know, you're doing a lot of work here. You have 7 seasons to get through.
Well, I'm almost through 2.
I'm
making some solid head.
Yeah, but like you do have the advantage of now a little hindsight where you can figure that out, where if you're doing a Kramit and going into season 5, some of this stuff might either be more important to you and you're or not.
Last week we discussed a little town called Karth.
Yeah.
Don't have to spend a lot of time there. So that's a great example of how you can jump way ahead when you know that you don't really need to know. Like Arya in Braavos as well. Like I don't need to spend a lot of time with oysters, clams, and cockles and her watching the play and all that. You can just kind of jump past a lot of that because it's not super plot relevant.
It would, which is always, especially.
So, Kartha is like, and she ends up in the city of Kartha, and then she moves on.
Do you at least include the vision, though, right?
She meets some warlocks, they stole the dragons, she saw a few things, and then she got some ships and left.
Exactly. And I mean, that's an example of, like, you can jump through a lot of stuff pretty quick. I mean, like, Reek, too, like, that's a season of plot, but I'll be able to go, like, and Ramsay Bolton gets his hands on him, turns him into Reek. He's better now.
Done and done. Like, he's better now.
Got that.
I want to start this week's episode with some questions from the fans. I have a Casterly Talk discussion channel on the Discord server that's attached to my Patreon page at patreon.com/KenNapsok. We have some questions from my faithful patrons, Kevin Smets, who's also a up-and-coming star in the movie Trivia Schmodown. You know this, both of you.
Mm-hmm. Of course. If you follow the Schmodown.
So yes, you do.
He's made a splash.
But he's got a question here. He says this: I planned on binging the series again before the final season, but now with Schmodown training, he drops it in there.
Oh, right?
And he's busy at work, all that kind of stuff. And again, a lot of episodes, 7 seasons. It's a lot of hours. And I'm trying to get through it. So he says this: hey, a quick question for returning binger. What, like, 6 episodes is a good watch down to really get the trilogy, get the feel going into season 8, the trilogy, but he used that word to just really get ready for season 8, like 6 episodes that would give you the flavor. That's tough off the top of our head. Now, listen, Mark Bernardin, I believe, did this a while ago going into season 7, I think it was. He put an article out of here's kind of, and I think Chris Taylor has done it too. Maybe it was Chris Taylor and Martin, my two old writer friends. Nice. Any thoughts here? Any key? Maybe it's not 6. Maybe there's little arcs, things you want to follow. Rachel, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think in season 1, the first episode and the last episode, because you start with ice and you end with fire, and you have a real sense of walkers, an introduction to the characters, where they're moving off to. I mean, episode 1 covers like the first 100+ pages in the first book. It really moves along at a fast clip, and a lot of plot stuff happens, and you introduce to most of the main players. So I think that's pretty important. And then, you know, Baylor's a great episode, but the important thing basically just is that Ned gets his head cut off. But the final episode, sort of, I think the final episodes in all the seasons are some of my favorites, because there's usually this big event in episodes 9. Sometimes there's some cheating, and there was the one in episode 8 or something like that. But in the final episodes, you get a real good sense of the consequence of said big event.
I like
and
that.
Then where everybody is.
Right.
So I can't narrow down to every season, but those would be, I think, a likely place to take a look.
Yeah.
And then I honestly think rewatching season 7 is probably the most important thing, just as in terms of an immediate setup.
An easiest thing to accomplish there. I like that too, Lon.
I mean, that is what I was going to say. Is I think you'd be best off just going back and rewatching episodes from the last 2 seasons.
Right.
But
right.
I don't think it's going to pay off from a story perspective to go back further than that. Right. You just wanted to get sort of a feel for it. You could pick, like, you know, fun random ones from every season, just to be like, what was going on back then? Oh, right. It was that. I would say avoid the big action ones.
You say avoid them?
Well, if you're just going back for a refresher. Season has like 1 episode that's very action-based, but it's not really moving a lot of the story forward. So you don't need to watch like the Battle of the Bastards or...
Battle of Bastards,
Blackwater.
I would say watch Blackwater only because it's still my favorite
you get what I mean. Like, you're doing a lot of the heavy lifting of the story. I think what Rachel said about watching like those finales, really doing, because that's a lot of the like, let's set up everything for the next
segment. Touching base with more characters then too, because you could almost look at the biggest big episodes is not bottle episodes per se, but you are tend to be in one place with that set of characters. A Battle of Castle Black, for instance, like you're not touching base with any of the other storylines, and you know it's not the only thing going on. Blackwater's cool because you're seeing both sides, and so that's a lot of characters are involved in that one. So that's a pretty good one. I mean, my favorite set piece episode is Hardhome, but I mean, all you need to know is whites, wildlings. You know,
there's zombies coming.
We're good. Yeah,
yeah. I see your point.
Like I was gonna say, like the season 1 finale, which I watched pretty recently, so it's sort of really fresh in my mind. Like that's very important in terms of like, here's setting up a lot of the divisions that were going on. Like, not only here's all the characters, but like, here's right. how they were kind of aligned against one another. And a lot of the events kind of culminated or recently culminated. So you get stuff like, you know, Jaime and Tywin versus Rob's army and what was going on there. And, you know, like Yoren got Arya out and now we're setting up all of her adventures on the road.
Heading out north of the wall. Right. Like that's when they're about
Yoren's taking her to the Night's Watch and Gendry and Hot Pie. I mean, you'd get Hot Pie that way.
You gotta get that.
What's going on with Hot Pie?
That's true. Yeah. Jorah's leading them. And actually, that's one of my favorite, that speech when he's talking to Jon Snow. Good. Oh, yeah. Cause I'm going to need you when we march in full north. I get chills, like nerd chills kick in because I'm ready for a battle. Unfortunately, it didn't go well for them. I think you're both right there. If you're pressed for time and you need to do it, pick up the pieces. Now, I was thinking season six ends, it does end with Cersei and the Light of the Seven and her revenge. That was unlike any other finale of any season to me. It was a big solution in a final episode.
And it was a cinematic set piece in a way that was different than a Battle of the Bastards or a Hard Home or Battle Castle Black. It was, you know, a whole lot of character work with such little dialogue and such huge repercussions. The Light of the Seven, that piece of music is probably my favorite from the whole series. I love the Lannisters Pay Their Debts, that theme, and the Stark theme, and we could go on and on.
I could sing the Reigns of Castamere with a little whiskey in my gullet.
Right. Yeah. But that's a set piece that's brilliant. And Lena Headey, man.
I'm throwing a curveball to you both here. And we'll get another question here from our listener Scribbler, which is one of my favorite names in my username verse out there. Thinking about the Light of Seven, that's like, all right, let's just say it's like 10, 15 minutes. I can't remember the exact runtime. That is some of my favorite minutes of Game of Thrones. Yep. Breaking down these things. Do you guys have any offhand go-to that you're just like, oh man, that's just, Hard Home's another one for me, when the dogs start barking. When they're there
that whole sequence.
And the dogs start barking, I still can watch it. You can hear my voice now. I get excited and scared and terrified. And that's a longer sequence. But do you have any sequences that jump off the page, Lauren? Anything that hits your brain? If you're just like, oh, this is why I love this show.
One thing that I watched again recently that really struck me, and I remembered watching it the first time, was when we're sort of exploring Craster's Keep,
right?
And there's that episode that ends with John seeing them take the baby, and then the White Walker gets to the baby turns. We still don't have like real payoff for that moment, but it's so awesome, and it is one of those moments that really clues you into. There's so much going on in this world that we've just started to scratch the surface of.
Right.
So that was really cool. I'll tell you one of the other moments that I remember that really stands out to me is sort of like, oh, there's a whole other thing going on here.
Yeah.
Was that flashback. It's one of the very few real like flashbacks we've ever had to ancient history to the children of the forest creating the Night King or creating the White Walkers.
Which is big really reveal too.
Big reveal and really like out there, very high fantasy, like more high fantasy than this show usually gets. Usually it's like very grounded and there's like a fantastical element. That's just straight up Lord of the Rings style, like fairy creatures creating a monster where, you know.
I love that. And there's to me a lot in that moment I still want to learn about whether we get the answer or not.
And it sort of introduces dragon glass having all these kind of magical properties or enhances our understanding of dragon glass.
To me, is that the same spot? Because that arrow, kind of that rock that.
Oh, yeah. The arrowhead shaped mountain.
It's like, it's all what's going on there. I love that. Yeah, exactly. So, that's a great example.
One other one that I remember is when they're in the arena, the Sons of the Harpy have attacked, and then the Drogon flies in and rescues Daenerys, and they fly out together. Just huge, I love that. Epic. I mean,
that's one of my big Sir Jorah moments. Saving the day there.
The payoff there is like she's not in control. You don't know where he's taking her. It sort of leads to this whole other adventure.
I love that's a really cool moment. I love that. Rachel, you got to have some more in your brain there.
I do. I have a couple of, they're a little more character driven.
That's great.
But Tyrion's trial, has always been one of my favorite sequences. I think that Peter Dinklage has never been better. And I loved all the moving pieces and Jamie and Varys visiting him in the cell and eventually Oberyn, you know, right, also. Right. But yeah. I love
King's Landing, not in the Eerie, very
good point. The season four trial. Because it's the final disintegration of his relationship with his family, and you can see it on his face. And then when Shay turns on him and he admits to being a monster and like just has it out on the entire court, and then I demand a trial by combat, and you're just like, holy crap. Yeah. I think that's a really great series of things that also leads up to, of course, the mountain versus the viper. And one of my all-time favorite scenes in the entire series, in the episode Kissed by Fire, Jamie and Bran in the bath.
Oh, the bathtub scene is spectacular.
It's to me quintessential Jamie, because you hear the story about what really happened with Aerys, and you just have this kind of gut punch of like what he's lived with and what he's sort of buried within himself and tried to convince himself that he doesn't care when, you know, he really does, because what he did would save a whole lot of people. Right. And Bran's realization of that. And it is the most non-sexual like bathtub scene ever. I mean, and they're both, I mean, Bran's not supposed to be good looking, but Gwendolyn Christie's a beautiful woman.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nikolai Coster-Waldau, I don't mind looking at either.
Yeah, yeah. Me either, for what it's worth.
But that's always when I get to that scene, it moves me every time.
It's amazing. Sometimes it's the conversations too. Tywin and Arya in season two, some of my favorite stuff, and the tension when Baelish shows up. But I talk about it probably too much. Fans are probably thinking, is this the only thing the guy ever saw Game of Thrones? That scene of Robert Baratheon, Barristan Stelmy, and then Jaime gets pulled in, and they talk about their first kills, which leads to the first time you ever see Jaime kind of go like, yeah, I know you all think I killed the king and I'm horrible. He wanted to murder you all. He wanted to burn everyone. There's that moment of, well, he said, you know, burn them all. And the look on King Robert's face, that's one of my favorite little moments that I could watch over and over.
I also do love, I didn't mention, like, one of my favorite characters that has a lot of, like, great character beats is the Hound. I think I'm blanking on the actor's name, but
Rory McCann.
Yeah, Rory McCann. And the way he's sort of handled that journey. I mean, speaking of a character who just seemed like the personification of evil and malice in the beginning. Well, the first thing we see is he murders Micah, the butcher's boy. But you know, to who's become sort of a fan favorite, a beloved character. His stuff with the Brotherhood Without Banners,
100%,
with him and Thoris of Mir and Beric Dondarrion kind of bringing him in, and after he's had his whole sort of conversion from Brother Rey.
Ian McShane,
beautiful, beautifully acted, incredible moment with those guys together. The Brotherhood Without Banners has really become to be one of my favorite sort of little groups of side characters from the show that were just like very shrouded in mystery.
I love that they really come back full force season seven, and that we you know, rest in peace Thoris of Mir. Paul Kay is fantastic as Thoris of Mir. I really do love them, and I know that sometimes maybe more book heavy at times, you know, Rachel, I don't know if you agree with that or not, where you get a little bit more of them in the books, so they factor in more, I guess, but
they do because of Lady Stoneheart. And you know, that is not the avenue the show went, but the show still kept the core idea of them as being a conduit for the Lord of Light in a way that's a separate from Melisandre. And I think that was very important, and I like that they kept that. And then to come back and hook them up with some other characters, like not just the Hound, but like Gendry.
Jorah
for the
all-star team
suicide mission north. Up north.
I love that episode. I guess people didn't like that Gendry runs so far, and I'll grant it's a plot hole. Like I'm not denying like he runs too far that should be possible, but I don't care.
I do agree with you on that one. I like a lot more seasons than other people, but I think just seeing I you know, could two of more of them have died? Okay, I can even spot you that. I swore Jorah was going.
I thought he was.
I
felt like, because they must have, I'm very intrigued about where he's going in this last season, because
Jorah?
It feels like his story kind of but it just feels like he had wrapped up like a season before the show got rid of him.
I think you're right. No, you I know, think you're
like
right.
He'd been lingering, and it felt like there must be some other angle.
I mean, I am, you know, people see Ser Jorah and Glenn, and they immediately text me, "Hey, saw you on TV." I get it, but I was slightly disappointed how fast the resolution, and I've talked about this on other Castle Talk episodes, but it did happen fast. Season 7 just was fast. Any way you sliced it, was fast. Yeah. And that did create some problems. But I don't know where, I don't know. I joke and say dead, but I just don't know what he can do as right. especially as it relates to Danny.
Exactly, because that's he could certainly still have an impact. He's he's a very talented, totally. Qualified knight, but it just seems like his personal story has kind of hit this endpoint impact.
It really seems when he comes back,
she just doesn't love him.
Yeah, when he comes back,
and that's a beat we've hit before.
We've hit it before.
She chose other men over him, and here we're going to see it again with John. So are we in for a repetitive?
I think they already played with it together. Yeah, I think they already played with when he comes back and he has that look like I get it. But I don't know.
But he's still there.
He's still there. We have a lot of still there.
And he's not even the only Mormont who matters at this point.
No, so. Let's not forget.
We could get a return to Bear Island.
I want Lyanna Mormont with a sword in season 8. I want her fighting, and she would be. She'd be out there.
100%. She'd be on the front line.
Wait, absolutely.
Book people, help me out here. What is the fate of Longclaw? Where is Longclaw right now?
Longclaw?
John still has it?
Yep. So there you go.
Yeah, because Jorah told him to keep it.
Yeah, Jorah gave John Longclaw and changed the pommel into bear to a wolf.
I do like that episode, particularly that you get some old school Game of Thrones in a way, which is weird to say old school because the show's been around now so many years. When they're taking their time having some fun conversations, then some deep conversations.
Oh, that's the best part of the episode to me. All the interactions and the conversations having. Yeah.
It's that stuff there. So a lot of, and you know, this is what I love. This is an episode we did not plan much, and and I love it. Jumping around here, it's like an episode of The Afternoons with Josh and Ken, where we start one place and we end up two worlds away. Going back to the Hound stuff and the season 7 Hound stuff, and even a little bit of what season 6 would be a little bit. But when he goes back to the farmer's house and finds the farmer dead with the girl and everything, but it goes to the point you talk about, and you talked about last week's episode, Lon, of the light of the seven, R'hllor, all this stuff. They seem to be the only one. Yeah, we got the faceless men. That things always seem to happen. Beric Dondarrion is 6 times proof that there's something in the water.
Resurrected Jon Snow, resurrected Beric Dondarrion, has turned Melisandre from some kind of old crone into Carice Van Houten.
Lucky her.
Yeah, I mean, with the shadow assassin that killed Renly Baratheon, which was really one of our very first indications that some of these religions have something behind them.
Yeah.
And I do like the idea that we know that certain religions have power. We don't really understand its alignment.
It
would be like in reality, like we don't know if the Lord of Light isn't benevolent.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Of course, it sort of seems like no.
Right.
Most of the things that he does is like murdering, and he needs you to murder somebody else so that he'll go do the murder.
It's the power of fire that stands the best chance against the White Walkers, which are our big bad. So it's an interesting sort of conundrum in terms of, like you said, alignment.
Is there any chance? Andres and I talked about this a couple weeks ago, but I haven't really discussed it with you. We touched a little bit on with the Night King. Any chance in your guys' mind that there's a flip? There's a big flippy-do, a big swerve, as they say in wrestling. And not necessarily the Night King, but the idea of fire being the thing that could stop ice turns out that that's what we don't want to have happen. Is there any kind of turn of the page where all of a sudden it's like, oh God, everyone put the fire out. We need ice. Like any kind of switch do you see?
It seems like a very Game of Thrones thing to do. I don't know if it'd be quite that
simplistic.
But I could see our good guys like balking at the idea of using this power against the White Walkers, because the power in and of itself is somehow evil or needs sacrifice. I mean, we can go back to the Shireen thing and Melisandre believing that in order to use this power, what is it going to cost our heroes, and I think that's a very interesting, possible obstacle for them to have to face.
I even like that, the cost of this. Maybe they have to use it and there's a cost.
Mm-hmm. Not to borrow from Avengers, but I mean, this could be sort of end game, could be yes, the Lord of Light and the power of fire has helped us to overcome the White Walkers, but now we are stuck in a world that is not necessarily the one we wanted either.
Right.
And I mean, like, you know, it could be that, you know, now we've swung too far the other way and there's fire creatures coming to kill us. That feels Martin to me. That, I mean, not that exactly. That kind of a turn does feel George R. R. Martin-y to me.
Yeah.
It'll be like, okay, you're going to place your faith over here.
Right.
This is a real power, but you're not going to like,
you
you're not going to
want that. Either.
You're not going to like the drowned God either. So, you know, like, no matter where you go,
dour deity,
all kind of bad.
I do think the faith of the seven is the only one that has no power whatsoever.
And this we were saying, I think before we started recording, this is something that I realize they've been layering in since season one.
Right.
In season one, there's a conversation that Osha has about how if you go south, if you go too far south, the weirwood trees are gone.
Right.
And there's no true religion.
Right.
And then they're like, well, I got, they've got, you know, the seven, mother and the whatever.
Crone and the father and the stranger.
She's extremely dismissive. That it's like, and it's not only that that's not a real faith, which you'd imagine somebody who believes a different religion would believe it, but it's that nobody, it's a fake faith.
Right, right.
And I think we've sort of followed that
through. It's an institution used to corral people and control them.
Yes,
and
that it's an institution of power.
Yep.
And then we really threaded that needle in the High Sparrow season where we realized even their sort of leader,
it is
everybody's kind of full of it and using it as a tool to manipulate instead of really believing it.
It's so fascinating to me. Yeah, the you know, Melisandre is one of my favorite characters, and I'm a Stannis fan, but there's just always been something because from her first, you know, moments with Maester Cressen, good old C.O. Bibble from the Star Wars prequels, you know, she out-poisons him, you know, takes the poison and survives. You're immediately like, what's going on? This is, you know, could it, is it a parlor trick? Is she learned this from, Princess Bride there, if you've seen it, but it immediately takes, you take notice of what's going on.
There's an interesting thing in the show as well, that it's not directly connected to religion, but it is sort of, where it's the family sigil has real meaning and significance.
Sure.
So like the Starks are direwolves as their symbol, but Bran actually can like warg into a wolf. And all of these kids were able to sort of bond very quickly with these direwolves who then become their protectors and their sort of avatars from then on. And Targaryens, obviously, like
dragons,
were right away. Not only just dragons, but Daenerys like can't be burned by fire. Like that's she knows Viserys isn't a true dragon because he can be killed by fire. She can walk into a funeral pyre and be fine the next day. So that's an interesting thing too, that we haven't necessarily, I mean, I don't think it'd ever be explained, but that's another level of sort of magic in this world that we don't really understand how it works.
Sure, of these big, powerful houses too.
And is that every house? Like, are the Tullys really great at fishing? Like, does it only extend to these houses?
They can hold their breath a long time underwater.
Right, because we don't even, Baratheons, I don't think they had any kind of connection to stags.
To stags, no.
Well, it's because they
They took it
from the Durandans.
Oh,
So, which we'll learn, hopefully, in the prequel series. Right.
Davos doesn't have onion powers, folks. Come on.
Maybe.
It's a fairly new sigil for him.
It can get onions into where you need to go. All right, we got this question here from, like I said, Scribbler. Jeff Saunders is his real name. But he asked this question. Hey, he says, question to the talk. I like that. I really expect some swerves and betrayals in the last season. Are there any characters that you would expect to turn on their friends /families, he says in parentheses, Jamie Lannister doesn't count. I can see that one coming without my glasses or corrective lenses. So thanks, Jeff Scribbler. Appreciate that question. We're coming to end game here. We got a lot of things going on. But, you know, Jamie, I think that's a correct answer. Like, Jamie, we know he's not on board with Cersei anymore. Any big swerves, Game of Thrones style, any I told you not to trust me, is anything like that? Rachel, do you got anything?
I felt like there was a hint at the end of last season of Tyrion feeling very out of place when he's like on the ship corridor and he's looking and he's very well aware that Jon and Dany are in her room doing things. And it struck me as he's betrayed his family and he's moved to this other side, and he's right. taken up her cause, and he found faith with her again. Mm-hmm. He has that speech with her when she makes him her hand. And then things don't really go his way in season seven. His plans don't bear fruit. He doesn't agree with her when she takes Drogon and roasts the Tarleys. And right. they seem to be a bit at odds. And him standing on the outside makes it sort of seem like now he's seeing Jon as having usurped a position of, you know, having her ear, if right. you will.
Yeah.
And totally. I think that he might feel like, where do I belong? Like, mm-hmm. I'm not really with my family anymore. This new alliance I made, I don't really feel like I fit in either. So I don't know if that will result in a betrayal, but I think that it will mm-hmm. result in tension.
Yeah.
And I could see, you know, if John and Danny are want to do the things that we know that they are want to do, which is charge into things without thinking about it and you know, making the wrong decision without, you know, sort of having a clear head, that he might go around them, that I see that there are possibilities there because I feel like he is in a bit of a precarious position as to, you know,
I like that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and yeah, you go around Danny, that might be betrayal to Danny.
She would see it that way, for sure.
That Targaryen fire and blood.
It's interesting. I mean, for so much of the show, we've been talking about, you know, your house is your team. And right. so the shift would be if you're going to back somebody else's team, you're going to go against, you know, whatever, your bannermen or whatever.
Yeah.
But I feel like because so many of these families have been routed at this point, I mean, the playing field is just sort of leveled.
I would agree,
I think the alignment now is between, you know, kind of Varys has always been like, who do you represent? The realm.
The realm.
And I think the alignment now is being self-serving versus greater good. And I think
that's a great point.
And I think that we may see characters that we expect to have a little bit more nobility maybe being in it for themselves. Like Sansa would be a great example.
Okay.
That, like, again, we've been talking about watching Cersei, watching Baelish, learning how to be a manipulator and a maneuver behind the scenes. She may yet see an opportunity to secure future power for the Starks at the expense of some of the collective war effort.
Right.
That's the kind of decision-making I'm sort of looking ahead to, more so than like, I'm going to, you know, like Littlefinger, like I'm going to play the Tyrells against the Lannisters against the Starks.
Yes.
There's just not, I don't know if there's enough power to go around.
There's a lot less players on the field.
Yeah.
Now.
So I feel like it may be more of a, like, pretend like you're going along with one thing, but then pull back. Or whatever. Like, wait, you know, we've had a lot of like, oh, well, the North is empty because they're going to go fight the Lannisters. Let's take this opportunity to take Winterfell. And like a lot of that kind of maneuvering that I feel like people like Arya, people like Sansa, it's going to be very tempting for them.
What could, excellent train of thought, because I still look at the, and I know you could probably look at the director list of the upcoming season and start to predict where things are. And I started to do that and I pulled out of that because I was like, I just don't want to know almost anything. Well, I'll watch a trailer that comes out, but it took me days to watch that little 6 seconds on the
like
HBO.
Like if they have Alan Taylor, Mikhail Sapochnik,
you're like, oh, this is a big battle. And there's some of those things lining up, but I still look at
Neil Marshall's coming back.
Right. Battle of Blackwater. I'm still looking at the idea that the battle with the Night King happens way sooner, and then the battle, not necessarily for the throne, but the hashtag for the throne is what they're going for. So it's part of the theme, but I think sometimes their season themes are loose. But then that gets into what you're talking about, Lon. So what happens after you win? You know, what happens? We killed him. It's a little cold, but we're okay. And everyone, it's like a fumble on a football field. The ball's on the field and everyone's looking and jumping.
There's no way the final episode of this show ends with the Night King beheaded and everybody's like, phew. Like, that's not this show. That's not.
I looked at the camera. Let's dance.
There are like everything in slow motion while they all hug. It's just not. That's not how Game of Thrones is going to wrap up. We all know. So, I would think by 6 or 7, we should basically will have figured out what's going to happen in terms of.
Well, so we got six episodes.
Oh, right. So by 4 or 5, we're going to figure out, like, here's the resolution of the main action story. And then, we're going to have to figure out What comes next for Westeros?
Yeah, I love this idea of the fight, and they all of a sudden they look down to King's Landing, like, there's still a throne. We need it. Cersei's there.
Or, I mean, it may not be the Iron Throne.
Right, right. Yeah. But
it may end up being some other version of how who's running Westeros moving forward.
I like that idea.
Who's in charge? Because, maybe it's in Winterfell now, and it's an ice throne.
That's the thing. Like, I feel like there would be a new...
New capital.
A new consolidation of power somewhere in an unexpected place based on what survives the upcoming battle and who survives it.
And even just the symbolism, like the Iron Throne so represents like conquest. And this new era might not be so much about like, I conquered everybody.
Yeah. I don't need a throne of swords.
Yeah,
I defeated.
Like I'm melting down all your family's swords into my chair. It might be a different vibe.
It's like a patent leather chair with a
I just came up with Ice Throne, but now that I've thought of it, that is pretty cool. Like that. I can see that.
I like this idea. Do you think we got Euron Greyjoy, Rachel? We got the Golden Company. We got a lot going on there.
We really haven't talked about the Greyjoy.
They're out there. You know what? That's actually a great little thing to talk about. And I know I was watching with Grace, and she's like, anytime the Greyjoys come up, I just don't like it. I get bored. And I turn away.
Oh,
I love Balon because I got to play him in School of Thrones. If you ever Google search it on YouTube. I played Coach Balon Greyjoy, the swim team coach. I like it, and I really do feel for Theon. I think he's one of those characters of you get where it went wrong. He paid for it, and I think he should have.
I'm worried about Theon because his most recent he ends season 7 on such a high.
It does.
It's never good in Game of Thrones. You don't want to be on a high where there's 7 episodes left to go.
And Yara, Asha in the books, right?
Gosh, yes. Really?
I haven't.
Because they thought it was too close to OSHA.
OSHA. So
they changed it to Yara.
Yara.
Yara?
She
confused me when I go back.
Yeah, she's still around, right? She's not...
She's a captive.
She's a captive of Euron, right?
That's how the season ends. He's like, we're going to go rescue her.
Right, because she did try to rescue him a while ago. Right.
Yeah.
Where did the Greyjoys factor in Endgame here, Lon? If Night King's snapping his fingers, are they going? Like, what's happening?
I genuinely don't know what's coming. My concern is that I really like Theon. I was sort of hoping he was going to have a... heroic kind of, he would find himself at some point. The fact that it's already happened leads me to believe that he's going to die.
He might be an early casualty.
I feel like
too.
He's going to probably die because now he's had his, like that scene and that conclusion felt like the cap of.
Right, right.
That's the, unless they've got one more big twist for him coming.
Right.
Like I was saying, there's that balance of, are you going to be for the common collective good?
Right.
He's a guy that when the chips fall, when it comes down to it, he often makes the self-serving decision.
He does. And he historically has. You're right. Maybe he rescues Yara and then the Greyjoys are like, cool, we're ready to fight. And Euron's upset at them and everything. But then they die in a battle versus the Night King. I don't know. There's something like that. Does that cheapen the journey of Theon, Rachel?
I'm not sure. Theon falls into a category for me of what I've called, I believe on the show before, is the category of survivors. And he's always been one that I thought would survive the whole thing.
Yeah.
Almost because he doesn't deserve it. And so that's the reason he would. In a way, I think he's gotten a brilliant arc. Mm. I've also gone on record saying I think Alfie Allen is one of the most, if not the most talented actor in the group to be able to pull off the nuances of a character that by every right we should hate with a passion.
Right.
I mean, betraying the Starks, burning those two little boys. It's very hard to come back from that in similar ways to Jamie coming back from pushing Bran out a window, but that's what makes it such a complicated and interesting arc. And I'll tell you, last season when he jumped overboard rather than fighting his uncle for Yara was a moment that felt so real to me. And I was so glad that was not the moment of heroism from him.
Yes.
Like that was the move he would make 100% based on everything we know about him, everything that he's been through, because I'm a firm believer in characters really having to earn a heroic arc like mm-hmm. that, and that it's a very difficult thing to do.
Sure.
It's hard to change your innate nature. His innate nature is that he is a coward.
Yeah.
That has always been the case, and that will never not be right. the case. Mm. So I like what he did at the end of the season, because there's a little bit of that feel of redemption. I don't know exactly. The problem is finding out how this ties into everything else. So
right.
he goes after Euron, which basically means his story intersects with the Golden Company story
right.
somehow, shape or form. So does Theon in some way find a way to keep the Golden Company from getting to Westeros? Is that the bigger thing he does mm-hmm. by going after Yara? I kind of, in my mind's eye, see like he gets to Yara, but like just too late, or maybe she, like, you know, she's dying, but like he gets one last moment with her before she dies
sure.
or something along those lines. And then he moves on to, you know, the greater battle, the,
I
you
like
know,
that.
Up north. But I see him making it. I see him making it the way that I see Sansa making it, the way I see Davos making it. Like there's just certain characters that somehow, some way, they've survived things they probably should never have survived.
Right.
And the fact that they keep doing so in such interesting and complicated ways makes me want to see him all the way.
Davos also has that, you know, I was talking about characters who sort of lose their faith early and then become more powerful afterwards. Davos is a great example. Like when we first met him, just convinced that Stannis was it.
Yep.
He's the king. He's the one.
Yes.
Much like our Ken.
Yes, I've attached myself to him. And then, watching Stannis fall, not only lose and be killed, but lose himself along the way.
Absolutely.
Has now made him, I think, a character with a lot of like sage wisdom.
There's a reason people listen to him.
And so I agree. I think he's going to make it to the sort of.
I need some peace for Davos.
I totally agree about Alfie Allen and the character. And I mean, one thing that's so impressive, Jaime Lannister, we followed along on this sort of redemptive path, but he was always. He's a good looking guy, but he's always very charming. Even though he did despicable things, he's
very much so.
You know, like he's the noble, blonde, powerful knight or whatever. He's funny. He's got a good personality. They made Theon unlikable from the very start.
Wanted to kill the wolf pups.
For the very first episode, he's kind of a weasel.
And
he's kind of shitty, and you just don't kind of like him. And so for them to keep him around all this time, have him do horrible things, and yet we're still kind of on his side, is amazing. It really is
I think the moment you meet Baelon, you're like,
I get it.
All that stuff there. Final question here tonight. This is kind of more of a fun one. Here comes from Tamor. Says, if all you were living in that time in this world, which house would you want to be in, and would you bend the knee to Daenerys Stormborn of House Targaryen? Tamor's a big fan of Daenerys, I know that. Mm-hmm. So usually this question gets asked at some point, what's your favorite house? What do you belong to? But I like that. I like the follow-up, though. Would you bend the knee? Let's say Daenerys takes over. Rachel, your house, and would you bend the knee?
Okay, this is difficult because you want to say that you're like a Stark.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to live in Winterfell at all.
Yeah.
Just no.
It's a little rugged.
Right. If you really thought about it, you'd be like, Highgarden.
I was going to say
that sounds really nice. And the climate's good.
Mace
they've got a lot of money, all of that
but
stuff.
You got Olenna. So.
Yeah. But I've actually always said, and it's... it's a little silly because it's not necessarily a house, and also women aren't allowed, so I'd be breaking all kinds of rules. Yeah. But the Citadel and an old town. I'd be in that library, and I'd be content being in that library. I would love to be a maester.
Which would be interesting, because I would love, if they, at any point, George deals with they change it, and it's not just septas and maesters now. Yeah. Anyone can be a maester. That'd be interesting. I could see that knowing you like I do, an editor likes to spend time in a dark room working on her stuff, and I've never heard anyone answer that. You're like Sam Tarling. You want to go down and walk into that library. I love that. That's a great answer. So then, I guess you'd have to bend the knee because maybe you get assigned to her house.
Probably. And, all things considered, despite some of the ways she's gone about doing things, I still believe in her philosophy of breaking the wheel and that her heart's in the right place. Even if she hasn't always gone about doing things the right way, she's about affecting change for the better, for the betterment of not just one class of people, but for all people. And, you know, like I said, she's gone about it in the wrong ways enough times, and she's learned. Pretty stubborn, but I would get behind that as a person that I would choose to follow.
Great answer, Lon.
I mean, I'm very, the idea of wanting to be in a nice climate in a house where they've got
factors in,
like Dorn, Martell being in Dorn feels very,
pretty good.
It's balmy. It's like Spain. You got
those water gardens.
They make the best wine down there. Like, I feel like that's very, just from a creature comfort level.
Yeah.
That is pretty appealing. I will also say though, that I think there is a lot of appeal to speak in some of these houses that are a little out of the way.
Yeah.
Like if you are a Frey, you are always like, everybody's got to pass through your backyard.
Right. You're seeing
you're like it. Right in the thick of it. But if you're in the Eyrie, you're kind of a little pushed back. Like, I don't think John Arryn being the hand of the king is what got him in trouble.
Yeah.
You can sort of kick it in the Eyrie. You're very well fortified.
Yep. As long as the dragon doesn't fly up there.
You got the moon door. Yeah. If you don't like somebody.
The sky cells. They're going to turn a lot of people
away.
They've
just been over there getting weird with each other for several generations now. I feel like there's some innate appeal
there. That's a good answer, too.
I might go to the Vale.
But that answer alone means you might be okay with Bended and Eve, but you're not going to rush to it.
And I think if you're a Dorne or the Vale, you're watching the way the winds are blowing. You're not jumping in.
You're kind of hanging back.
Exactly.
Dorne feels they don't have to.
Is this working out? Is she taking control of the rest of the Seven Kingdoms? All right. We'll team up with you. If not, maybe we'll figure out what's going on ourselves.
That is interesting. She gets any kind of power in Westeros, Dorne will be like, "Yeah, we fought, Aegon before.
Just leave us.
We're not going
to
battle.
We're
the
very
dragons.
Far south. Yeah. You don't need to come down."
I always joke. You know, a lot of people know I love the Night's Watch, and I actually do love cold weather. I don't know if that might be too cold for me, but I do love the Night's Watch. There's something about it. I love kind of the standing on the wall garden. I know everyone always
celibate night for life.
Well, you know, there's Molestown, but I always do. I really like it, but I'm not going to answer that there because that also means I wouldn't have to bend the knee. Stark is interesting to me. I do love it. Weather aside, there's something there about it. And I always like, you know, sometimes you want to get cute and answer all the smaller houses.
House Tully
is good too.
Excellent fisherman.
Yeah.
I like fish.
I'll cheat. Sure. I'll say House Stark. Only because I really do still love Ned, and I think he was his own worst enemy at times because he was so damn nice and good and honorable. And I like the Starks, right? I do like the Starks. There's a part I wish I could answer a Hedge Knight or someone who just Davos. I'd love Davos, an Onion Knight. He was
being the Kingsguard. Or something.
Yeah, like I liked, and I think I would after seeing. I think I'd be initially like, who the hell is this girl on a dragon? Oh, she just burned. If I was the Tarleys, I would have bent the knee so quick with that drag. Honor be damned. I want to live to tomorrow.
I think the one group I definitely would not fit in with would be the Dothraki. I would not prosper in vice.
It's like a roving Burning Man.
It's just not going to be my speed.
I don't like camping.
No.
I do love Jorah. So House Mormont's interesting too, and I like Lyanna.
It looks very nice. Yeah. It's lovely there.
It's lovely.
And you definitely are like out of the way
harsh,
up there.
It is harsh and unforgiving and apparently full of bears.
Yes.
But
yes.
Like you have to watch out for bears.
I'd be okay with that. Hell, maybe I've just become free folk. Nah, actually I wouldn't do that.
I'm going to ask you a question because the books again. Where is Tarth? We've never seen Tarth.
The Isle of Tarth is south and off.
Like off the coast of like Storm's End.
Storm's End. And
Tarth has never mattered other than giving us Brienne.
Brienne, and then when Jaime uses it to lie about her father, Selwyn Tarth will give. But no. I don't think it will factor. But I remember there was season one, other than this, you knew Samwell Tarly. I forgot going back and one of my first or second rewatches, the House Tarly and Randall Tarly does come up a lot before you even meet him. So the Tarlys had a place in there.
That's what's great. I mean, I've talked about the example before of Brendan Tully.
Yeah.
There are Blackfish, they give you those names. The other one that was was amazing to me on the most recent rewatch, just now we've gotten the Umbers are important in the North and the Grovers.
Right.
The Glovers.
Glovers. House Glover.
Yeah. They're all in season one.
They're main bannermen to the Starks.
All the scenes with Rob where they're debating who's going to lead John the Umber. Vanguard and... They're all there. Yep. And I was like, I thought these were all new characters.
Little John.
All there. They set up the, no Umber's going to march behind a Glover. Like, it's all in season one. It's amazing.
It is amazing. The show rewards itself. The story rewards itself. Yeah, that's your meat is really tough. And then, the Umber's flag, the sigil's hanging behind him there.
It's
so
crazy.
It is great. It's
that worked out.
It's all good. Great questions. Thank you all who participated. You can go to Ken Napsok's Patreon page. Hey, that's me. Patreon.com/KenNapsok. It's weird to speak in third person. One of my Deion Sanders or Jagan Hagar. You can follow over there. Follow me at Ken Napsok. Use the hashtag Casterly Talk. We are on Anchor, but the podcast is available in a lot of spots. You can support us directly on Anchor, but also you can find us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and all that stuff. Rachel, beyond just competing in the Schmodown and being a great presence over there, you are on Twitter if they want to reach out and talk Game of Thrones with you as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Twitter and Instagram at Rachel J. Cushing.
Sounds good. And Lawn Harris, we know you're at Lawns, the greatest Twitter handle ever.
For sure.
But you have been working on this thing for Screen Junkies fandom.
It's going to hit a few weeks before the new season.
Okay.
So by the end of March, we should be finalizing everything.
That's great.
Yeah, it's going to be an exhaustive, here's what you need to know from all of Game of Thrones.
Love it.
We may miss a few names here.
I'm sure.
We may not get to everything involving Ser Meron Trant, hopefully. His offspring aren't coming back.
Sir Boros Blunt.
We know nothing about his family, just him. So who knows?
Screen Junkies presents Game of Thrones Cram It. Here's all the Kingsguard. Good night. Good night. Yeah. I mean,
it's very challenging. You don't know what's going to come back.
Just make sure Mace Tyrell has at least an appearance in there somewhere. Mace,
I'm working on it.
We make our Mace. That's great. You're the best one to write that there, Lon. So look forward, guys, on Screen Junkies. We appreciate you so much here on Casterly Talk. We love interacting with all of you on Twitter. So use that hashtag Casterly Talk, and we'll see you next time. All right, season 8, it's almost here. Let's get ready.